start.
Hey, it's Aga and Werner, and this is the Catching the Next Wave podcast, where we discuss the future of design.
Today we speak to Joe Pine, author, strategist and thought leader. Joe is arguably the patron saint of experience design because of the book The Experience Economy that he co-authored. The book was written in 1999, but yet it still has an enormous impact on you and me and design as it stands today. Joe started his career working at IBM, where he spent around 14 years, moving on to Stone Mantle, a consultancy where his experience and body of work shapes the design of experiences. He's also the co-founder of Strategic Horizons, a thinking studio dedicated to helping businesses embrace and leverage the power of experience economy. And Aga, the first time I got to meet Joe, it was actually in 2D, transporting a very large painting of his likeness on a train from Warsaw to Wrocław. Why? Well, something I haven't mentioned yet, Joe is also the headmaster of the College of Extraordinary Experiences. And when you are the headmaster, you also have to have a portrait of yourself in the school. Joe, thank you so much for joining us. It's really awesome to have you on our humble little podcast. Thanks for spending your time with us.
It's my pleasure, Werner and Aga.
There is this famous quote from William Gibson, who said that future is already here, but it's not evenly distributed. How appropriate is the statement with respect to experience economy in your perception?
There is a differential in how industries and companies are embracing the experience economy, but it's actually, you can also extend it in the past because experiences have always been around. They're not the future in that standpoint. It's a distinct economic offering that has always been around. We've always had concerts and plays and sporting events. So the past was unevenly distributed as well. And what's different today is that the experiences are becoming the predominant economic offering, that more and more companies are getting into experiences, are staging experiences. So it really raises the bar on everyone to be able to figure out where they stand in today's experience economy.
We are being asked about the origins of the experience economy a lot. But we are not going to do this. I dug up an article from a year back that you wrote telling the whole story of how it started in 1993.
Oh, yeah. That was a thoughts post on our website called The History of the Experience Economy. Mostly I did that because people kept referring to our Harvard Business Review article from 1998 as the first time. And no, actually, we'd published several times before audit. That was the first one that got wide notice because of where it was, and it was a year before the book came out. So I wanted to sort of lay that out in terms of how we figured it out and what we published on it.
We'll just put the link to this article so everyone who is interested can read it, and you don't have to tell the story for the probably 1,000th time again.
Very good.
But for our listeners, could you tell a little bit more about what the model of progression of experience economy is all about?
Sure. I mean, it basically starts from the beginning, which is like the agrarian economy that lasted for millennia based off the commodities that we grow in the ground, raise in the ground, or extract out of the ground. And then we shifted into an industrial economy based off of goods after the Industrial Revolution in the 18th century. In the latter half of the 20th century, we shifted into a service economy where services became the predominant economic offering, where services were what consumers and businesses wanted. In the 21st century, we have shifted into an experience economy. So the key thing to understand is that experiences are a distinct economic offering, as distinct as services are from goods and goods are from commodities. It's basically when you use goods as props and services as a stage to engage each and every person in an inherently individual way and thereby create a memory, which is the hallmark of the experience. So we, in fact, have shifted into an economy where experiences are the predominant economic offering. They're what consumers and businesses are looking for. Experiences are where growth and jobs and in GDP are going to come from. And experiences is therefore where companies need to innovate.
And Joe, arguably when I first read the book, right, I actually didn't realize that it was written in 1999 or before, right? And then seriously, I kind of thought it was like written a year ago. But then that left me with the question, because I still feel the content is super relevant today. But then how was it received when you first released the book? What was the reaction back then?
Well, thank you. That's a high compliment, you know, because it is an enduring book. It is something that, you know, even though we updated it in 2011, yeah. and we're looking at something next year for the 20th anniversary, it's not a fad, right? It's an enduring thing that's going on through the economy. And so that's why it's as relevant today as we wrote it. The major thing that back in 1999 and early 2000s is that when I would talk about that progression of economic value, that I go through examples of that, as I had to convince people. You know, people were sort of like, well, I'm not sure about this, you know, what are you, and ask a lot more questions and basically be convinced. Today, I just have to say it and people go, oh, yeah, I get it. Right? That's the major difference, right? They get it today because it's so obvious. The other thing I'll mention, too, is we originally got a lot of pushback on one particular point about how if you stage experiences, you should really charge admission. You should charge for the time your customers spend with you because that's what they value. And we had only a few pseudo examples of retailers that charged admission. Now there's dozens and hundreds of places where retailers and restaurateurs and even manufacturers, you know, create brand places that they charge admission to, events that you charge for that you never thought possible, you know, outside of the normal experiences that we've had forever. So that also is now something that people can see much more readily.
Great point.
When you look back, where were the frontiers or where are the frontiers of experience design?
And experience design is still very much more art than science. So there's still a lot of ways to go to sort of figure it out. Two key frontiers, I think, are number one, mass customizing the experience. That, you know, my first book was Mass Customization. If you read that article in the history, you'll see how I figured out that customizing a good automatically turns into a service, customizing a service turns it into an experience. And there still aren't very many examples of mass customized experiences. You think about, you go to a Disney theme park and it's very much of a mass experience, or a sporting event, even a concert and so forth, is they aren't doing anything differently on stage for you. You're just part of the masses there. So there's one of my clients has really made huge strides in this. Carnival Corporation has come up with this ocean medallion that they have, this IoT device that allows them to identify every person, know who they are on the ship, and understand what it is that they desire, and thereby be able to mass customize the cruise ship experience to each individual, to each family unit, and each gathering. They can even understand the context of where you're at. For example, they can learn that when you're on the pool deck with your kids, your favorite drink is an iced tea with no lemon. When you're in the bar with your buddies, it's a mojito. And then when you're in the restaurant with your wife, it's a glass of Shiraz. You know, same customer, but what's the context? What market am I in at the moment? So they've developed this experience platform that goes across the entire cruise ship experience, beginning from your home when you get ocean ready, as they call it, to upload your passport and get all the information that they need and start to tell them what your preferences are, and even extending it beyond the cruise through the memorabilia that they have and the media that they share with you. So it is quite a wonderful, wonderful example. I think it's going to point the way for many others to go across that frontier of customization. The other frontier that I think is out there is around digitization, in that use of digital technology to create virtual reality, augmented reality, and things like that. There are many companies that are working towards sort of figuring out what is the model for virtual reality. And I tend to think, if for the most part, it's not going to be a home set. It's not going to be something you do in your home. Because if you do, you basically have to have a dedicated room. Because once you put those glasses on, you can't see anything. And the chances that you run into furniture and walls and break your TV and computers and all that are just way too high. I think the answer is more purpose-built environments, like a company called The Void from Salt Lake City, that has created these physical environments where the physical environment matches the virtual experience. So even though you've got full goggles on and headset, you don't see anything real. But when you see steps in front of you, you actually can walk up the steps. There are actually steps in the exact same sequence. If you have a torch to pick up, you reach out your hand and there's an actual physical object there that you can feel the heat from on top. When you're going outside in the game, you can feel the temperature change and the wind blow and things like that. That's going to be sort of the future of that. But we've got to figure out all of how we're going to use digital technology and be able to do that. It's why I wrote my last book, Infinite Possibility, Creating Customer Value on the Digital Frontier, to describe a model to help figure out all the different ways that we can fuse the real and the virtual.
I remember when you for the first time mentioned to me the Carnival Corps, which was for the seed cards, which is one of the examples that's there. I was fascinated how they build it from the organizational perspective. How do you create an environment within the organization that actually allows for building experiences?
It is, again, more of an art than a science. So many companies are going to do it differently. In Carnival's case, they plucked out of Disney a wonderful guy by the name of John Padgett to be their CXO, their chief experience officer. And he worked on Magic Band and helped make it a reality at Disney, but was always frustrated because of the fiefdoms there. He couldn't get everything to happen that he wanted, including the level of customization that he thought was appropriate. And so he really had this greenfield at Carnival. And what he did is he created an Experience Innovation Center, an XIC, he called it, right? So Experience Innovation Center, where he would house all of his people, the consultants that he was using, the systems integrators and coders and so forth, to be able to make all this happen. And he went through generation after generation of physical model of what the experience would be like on the ship. You know, creating models of the staterooms, of the hallways, of the retail and other places. And he would bring executives through there and say, this is what we're thinking, this is what we want to do. And so all of these executives would come through there and very much of a, you know, this is a, starts off, this is a far off thing, what we're thinking about, what do you think, and get their feedback and incorporate ideas and get them used to it. And one particular one, they said, okay, we're ready to start thinking about how we're going to actually implement this. And the president of Princess Cruises, you know, stood up and said, you know, she wants to be the first one. She wants to be the brand that brings that out. So there's the internal champion there that could really, you know, make it happen. And then everything has flowed from that. They've been moving up very slowly, you know, because, you know, eventually they want to have every guest on every of their 100, you know, 10 brands and 100 ships that they have. But they're working first with Princess, getting on multiple ships, working up to getting it to be every passenger as they work all the kinks out. A lot of technology, as you imagine, as they put 7,000 sensors on a ship and all the wiring has to go in there and so forth, and redo all the staterooms with a TV, you know, touchscreen TVs with door handles that open at your touch and so forth. So, you know, I think it's a very good model to think about. So let's innovate around these experiences, create an innovation center that allows us to try this out, test it, expose the internally to it, and develop that champion and how they go forward.
And Joe, it's really interesting that you mentioned that there's a champion in this case, right? And when I listen to you, I hear a lot of investment from a perspective of, let's say, in my world where I'm a consultant and maybe Aga, who also walks into customers, or maybe I'm in a corporation, I want to do things like that. How do you take this idea into the boardroom? How do you convince or get some traction within the leadership space to get a company to move in that direction?
The big thing is to convince them of the need to change. Things are different than they used to, that the bar has been raised, that consumers are looking for different things. One of the ways that we often do that is to take executives on a learning excursion, you know, an experience expedition to a city, and let them experience it as a customer. You know, even if it's, whether it's their competitors or generic ones, let them see some of the best experiences in the world out there, and maybe some of the worst, which might be in their own industry. I remember taking a telecom company from Finland, actually, over to New York, did an experience expedition with them there. And I cycled them through these like four different telecom mobile storefronts. And, you know, by the third or fourth one, multiple people said, okay, we get it. They stink, right? Because they see these great ones and then they go here and they say, okay, we get it. That's the sort of thing you need to have. You know, you need to get to that point where you realize you have to make change.
That's a great insight. I mean, we always tend to show the good.
Right.
And maybe tipping over to show where it's really bad also kind of jiggles the mind.
Right, exactly.
What are the biggest barriers for companies to break through in order to even start thinking about experience economy? Because, like, of course, you mentioned that they have to change, but change is so hard.
The change in my mind always has to start with mindset. You know, mindset is the biggest barrier, that if you continue to think about the situation in old ways and use old vocabulary and not embrace new ways of thinking and new vocabulary, it's very hard to change and to break through and become, you know, a premier experience stager. One of the things I'm battling with a lot now, actually over the last, you know, 5 or 10 years, is the phrase customer experience. customer experience basically came about because of the experience economy, but it, to my degree, how it's normally used, not always, there are some people who do it right, but it's really a bastardization of our concept. That normally when people talk about customer experience today, they mean let's make things nice and easy and convenient. That's all well and good, but those are service characteristics, right? That's the service mindset, nice, easy, convenient, not experience characteristics. Instead of being nice, you really need to rise to memorability. You need to make your experience memorable to be a truly distinctive experience. Instead of being easy, you need to reach inside of people and create that personal experience, not just easy for everybody, but what's the right experience for you. And convenience is the antithesis of what I'm talking about, because convenience is getting in and out as quickly as possible, spending as little time with the company as possible. When experience is about is designing the time that they spend with you so that they value that time and come to view it as time well spent. So you got to embrace a new mindset and new vocabulary.
Joe, you just alluded to the next part of our interview. I came from an advertising agency and then I dropped right into the world of user experience design. And there was a major contradiction for me between the two worlds. Then when I heard you speak about the following topic, the light went on. So last year when we were at the college, you spoke about time well saved and time well spent. That's a framework that you've introduced recently. Can you explain how that fits into the idea of the experience economy?
The experience is about designing the time. And if you think about that customer experience and what people are looking for from services, it really is about time well saved. They want it nice and easy and convenient. They want to get in and out as quickly as possible. They want to spend as little time. It's why you see the rise of such of internet retailers that save you so much time versus driving or transporting to a store and shopping around when I can see everything right there online. But with experience, it is about time well spent. It's that people value the time they spend with you. They get done with it and they talk about how much they enjoyed it. They remember it because of that. And so as an experienced stager, you really need to design time. It's funny you mentioned user experience. The gentleman who I think coined that term is Don Norman, who used to be at Apple user experience design, and now he's a professor in San Diego. I was able to have dinner with him not too long ago. And I just quoted him Monday in a class that I did. I teach in the summers at Columbia University. And I quoted him talking about how it's the design of time. That's what it is. And I also often quote John Jurdi, a famous architect who designed Bellagio in Las Vegas and many other experiences. And he says what they do is that they design time. Then when it comes to theater, I love talking about the Freytag diagram, which is how an analysis of plays and how they change over time. Time is the key with experiences. You're designing time for your customers.
That's great.
You also mentioned in your time progression model something which is called time well invested.
Yes, and time well invested is the next stage. That, in fact, I'll go back one stage too, which is that below time well saved is time wasted. Time well saved is a good thing. I'm not saying it's a bad thing when that's what people want. Time wasted is a bad thing, right? Time wasted is when you ask people to give you the same information that they've given before. When you make them wait in a very long line because you don't have enough people to be able to handle it, or wait on a call center queue and so forth, making them do things that aren't really necessary to get the value that they want out of it. All of that is time wasted. So you go from time wasted to, okay, let's do time well saved. And then you get to time well spent, where there's one more level there that is time well invested, where the time that you're spending is not just enjoyable in and of itself and valued for the time itself, like any experiences, like going on a cruise, going to a theme park, going to a sporting event, so forth. But in fact, that I'm using this time to invest in my own future. I'm using the time to transform myself into something that helps me achieve my aspirations. And in fact, that's directly related to the fifth and final economic offering in our progression of economic value, where you go beyond the experiences to create what we often call life transforming experiences, experiences that change us in some way. And those we call a transformation, right? So a transformation is when you build atop the experiences as the raw material to guide people to change, to help them achieve their aspirations in particular. And those experiences then are invested in making the transformation that you want. So time well invested is the final element in that time progression.
I'm so happy you mentioned transformational experiences, because I know this is something that you're really focusing on as well. And that's in the book also put in quotes, the final stage. Between myself and Aga, we've had many debates around transformational experiences. Yeah, yeah. As what does that mean? And is this viable for any size company? Do we need to focus on that as the ultimate
goal?
Great
questions. It really is the final stage that we've thought long and hard about it. Is there another economic offering after transformations? And there's a couple of reasons why we think no. Basic heuristic is that with the dynamic of shifting up this progression of economic value by extracting commodities and making goods and then delivering services, staging experiences, and guiding transformations, there's also then a second dynamic of commoditization, where commoditization drags you down. If you do nothing, you'll end up being undifferentiated and treated like a commodity. And then the third dynamic is customization, where customization lifts you up. You can't help but not be a commodity if you're customizing to individuals, because you're differentiating. You're working with them individually. As commoditization drags you down, customization lifts you up. That's how we discovered, you know, what happens when you customize an experience is where you get that life transforming experience. So we look at that with transformations and we say, well, one is, can you commoditize a transformation? Well, no. Why? Because with a transformation, the customer is the product. Right? You're actually transforming them from the inside out. And human beings are inherently unique, have inherent value that resists any form of commoditization. And then customization. So what happens when you customize a life transforming experience? Is there any higher level you get to? And the only thing we could think of that would be more than just another transformation is perfection, is perfecting people. And that's not the province of man, that's the province of God. So we figured that couldn't happen. We also looked at, you are what you charge for, and every one of those has different levels of charging. With experiences, you charge for time. With transformations, you charge for outcome. We couldn't think of any other way of charging for value other than for stuff with commodities, things with goods, activities with services, time with experiences, and outcomes with transformation. So that's why we do believe that it is the final economic offering. And we do believe it is something that is going to become more and more prominent. I see it more and more these days. I do a lot of work with tourism. And transformative travel is like this huge big thing in tourism. People understand that they want to go places that are actually going to make a difference in their life versus just spending a week somewhere with nice but still mere experiences versus those that are going to enhance their lives in the future, that it is that time well invested. So we will see it more and more in more and more industries, particularly as experiences eventually get commoditized, when that then becomes your choice, shift up to transformations or become a commodity.
Brilliant. And then Joe, like earlier in the conversation, you mentioned on mass customization. And for me, I mean, this untapped potential, especially when you look at the new technologies coming out, because it kind of aligns itself really to that mass customization. What is the role of these new emerging technologies within transformational experience?
Well, it's going to be very important because, you know, again, with your experiences are inherently personal. They happen inside of you. Transformation actually change you inside. So again, the better you customize, the better you're going to be able to figure out what is the transformation that people need. We talk about a three-phase model in Chapter 9 of the Experience Economy for Transformations that starts with diagnosis. Diagnosis, okay, who is this person? What do they want to become? Then design the set of experiences that are going to effect that transformation. Well, you have to understand this person individually. I mean, we can talk generically about how fitness centers transform you from flabby to fit, about how hospitals transform you from sick to well, life coaches that enhance your life and so forth, but those are all at the generic level. At diagnosis, you have to get down to the specific individual level of this person. Then you design the set of experiences, and that's where you're customizing these experiences. And if you mass customize, you do it efficiently, then you're going to have lower costs and you're going to have greater value. And you're going to actually do better for the person versus craft customization, where you don't always know what you're actually going to get because you haven't figured it all out. So you've got the diagnosis, you've got the experiences. You also have the follow through, ensuring that the transformation takes hold. That also requires understanding this individual, their psychology, what motivates them, and so forth. So the customization is actually crucial to transformations.
Is the word economy really appropriate for transformation? Because if this is such an individual thing, does it fit into the economy and business domain?
Yes, because, well, think about it this way, is that the history of economic progress is charging a fee for what once was free. in other words, that we did ourselves. In the agrarian economy, we grew our own crops, right? We had our own vegetable gardens and maybe a chicken or two and some pigs lying around, and we were responsible for that. Then as farms could get bigger and they could get more productive, we could pay other people for the farm products rather than do it ourselves. With goods, we used to make our own clothes, to make our own tools that we'd use in our vocation. Now we pay other people to be able to do that so we can specialize on what we do best. It's a law of comparative advantage applied to individuals and companies, not just to nations. With services, we used to be responsible for cleaning our own clothes, cutting our own hair, making our own food. Now increasingly we pay other people to do that. One of my favorite examples there is changing the oil in your car. You know, I don't know anybody that changes the oil, their own oil in their car. Right, it is possible. I did it once in my life. My first car, first time I did oil change, and I said, okay, done with that. I'm going to pay somebody to do that. And then same thing with experiences. Yeah. We used to be responsible for our own experiences. You know, whether in my family growing up, it was a big Sunday dinner that we'd have in the middle of the afternoon rather than the evening. And I think so we could take a nap afterwards. You know, that was a big experience. You throw a birthday party and you make your own games that the kids would go through. Now we hire somebody else to do those. Increasingly, we make part of the economy by paying somebody else for what we used to do ourselves. And the same with transformations. We've always been responsible for our own transformations. Increasingly, we're going to be paying people, paying companies to help us. Not, they can't do it for us. We still have to do it. And that may be part of what you mean by it's not part of the economy, because you may have the same saying over there that we do here in the U.S. that you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, right? So yep. You can do everything for a person, but if they don't want to change, it's not going to happen. So it is guiding. You can't guarantee it. It is dependent on them. But people who really are committed then, they need help. They are so often can't do it themselves. So they're willing to pay other people and companies to help them achieve the aspirations that they have.
The thing with transformation is that you have to be ready for it. You need to have mental space to become transformed. Right. Does it mean that any business, bank, insurance, telecom, are they going to keep on transforming us all the time?
Great question. You're exactly right. You need to be in the right frame of mind. You need to have space for it. That's one reason why you see so much more in transformative travel, is when we get out of our routines, when we get rid of the things that are filling up our minds and our time daily, and we go someplace else and we open up our minds, then we're more open to change than we are at any other time. So that's a key aspect of it. But our company is going to have to do that all the time. Well, you know, probably not. There are aspects, however, where companies can enhance us and help us, even if it's not a full transformation offering, if it's only what I might call transformational or transformative. Yeah. Just like there are experiential things without being full on experiences. So it's a matter of being able to analyze where are there times when the customer is ready for it, that you're giving that transformational aspect or even a full transformation that they're paying for the outcomes that they get. None of the economic offerings go away, right? You know, we still have to grow food and so forth. We still have to make things and deliver services. So many companies, they will provide aspects of all of it. You go to a Disney theme park, you're still buying goods, Mickey Mouse hats and watches and t-shirts and so forth. You're still buying services, so parking services, food services, photographic services, but you go for that experience and that drives the demand for the others. So a telecom company, you mentioned insurance, financial services, banks and that, they're still going to have the service levels of what they do, but then they'll have experience levels for when you're spending time with them. And then there will be you are ready, when it's the right thing to do to do the transformation. I actually do think that insurance and greater financial services, including banking, insurance, and other things, really should view themselves as in the transformation business, for the simple reason that money, at least for most people, is a means to an end, right? Not the end unto itself. The end is what you're going to use that money for. The end is sending your kids to college. The end is going on a great vacation once a year, retiring well, and so forth. If you can sell the ends rather than the means, then you're going to create and therefore make much more economic value.
Always there's this saying, like, we don't want home loans, we want homes.
Right, exactly.
Right. So maybe a mistake that you make is that you think that as a business, you have to focus on developing your own transformational experience for your customers, but rather looking at your customer's ultimate transformation. You might only play a small role in that transformation.
That's an excellent point. Still today, most people are affecting their own transformations. Right, they're responsible themselves, and they're looking for companies to fill slots in there. You know, so if I want to become more healthy, you know, I'll hire my fitness center for this portion of exercise. I'll hire a dietitian for this. I'll hire Weight Watchers to, you know, for food that I purchase, or I'll go to a grocery store that will allow me to purchase the right food so I can eat well and so forth. But there is that opportunity for, okay, is there some overarching thing for which all of these individual companies then are the suppliers for it. And that's, I think that is how the model will develop.
Very interesting.
When I'm listening to what you're saying, I get more and more impression that on this final level, it's more about creating platforms for transformation than creating transformations. This is one thing that I wanted to ask your opinion about. And the second, customer experience is something that's really fashionable here in Poland as well. So whenever we are trying to convince clients to design for experience, at least I stopped talking about designing experiences, because then they think in terms of like huge investments and like changing the whole company, and that never happens. I started talking to them about designing micro experiences. Sort of you build one next to the other, and together they create something that can be called an experience, because this is just easier for the companies to digest and to accept and to kind of push them towards that change that you are mentioning. So my question is, first of all, whether this idea of thinking about platforms is a right direction, is it the good way of thinking? And the second, isn't it a similar situation with transformations, that you think about small elements that help people transform rather than, again, thinking in terms of huge projects that are going to be transformative?
Yeah, I think those are both excellent thoughts that I hadn't thought about myself before. And so we'll now do so. But I increasingly think about experience platforms. You know, in fact, I was talking to somebody yesterday that wants to create a new experience platform. You think about how Airbnb last year announced that it was basically becoming an experience platform, not just a room platform. Marriott and Delta both now don't just offer you a hotel room or a flight for your frequent flyers. They now have all these different experiences that they offer you for when you travel, and they are becoming experience platforms. So the notion that you would have a transformation platform is an excellent one, and I hadn't thought about it before. But I think, yes, is that you can have a platform that allows you personally to be able to put together the elements that you want to be able to transform, just like you can now put together a vacation for a week. You can now put together a transformation for a week or a month or a year. There might also then be companies that, because they learn more about you, can take over some of that for you and become that primary transformation guider. And the same thing with micro, or I usually use the term mini just to get a little bit more, but mini experiences, that's a great way to get them going. Then you begin to connect those mini experiences together and to a full one. And the same may be true with at the transformation level, where it is sort of these mini transformative experiences that you go under that may not all be geared and fit together properly, but as you do more and more of them, you begin to figure that out. And you might be able to use that to get into the full transformation business.
Whenever you are talking about who you are designing for, or like talking about companies that are in the domain of experiences, we both do with Werner, we typically work with service companies, trying to convince them that the way to differentiate for them is to go into experiences. But many of these companies, they are so well trained into thinking about delivering a convenient service that's easy to use, that saves you time, so that this is truly against their nature to think about designing for spending time well. All these things, they feel very alien to them. You said that naturally companies go from commodities to goods to services than to experiences. Is it better to go through an evolution or a revolution? Why I'm talking about this? Because we also discussed some time ago Umpqua Bank, which is an amazing example of a very experiential bank. They did more of a revolution, from what I understand, than an evolution. What is your take on it?
Yeah, Umpqua Bank is like the only bank I ever cite that I think really gets experiences. So the answer to every question I learned long ago from my father was, it depends. And so it depends on the particular situation and their environment. Both can work to evolve into becoming an experienced ager or to go under or go a revolution to really change things. So a lot of it depends upon the current situation. Are they on a burning platform where if they don't change, they're going to die? Then it calls for more of a revolution. Are they able to internalize that opportunity and really see from the CEO and on down that there is this huge opportunity here? Let's go make this happen. They can undergo revolution as well. But for many companies, it's okay to develop experience innovations that move you in the direction from, you know, surrounding your services until one day you wake up and look, well, look, people value our experiences more than our services. And let's, you know, we're now an experienced stager. So either one can work in the same way as you shift up into transformations. If you're more of a startup, then I would certainly recommend go to the highest level you can and then figure out what you need to do underneath that. Because certainly all of these, and it is important to understand, all of these are built on top of each other. Goods are made out of the raw material of commodities. Services are things that act on those goods. Experiences surround those services, and transformations, again, are built atop the life-transforming experiences that we undergo. No matter where you are, you're going to have to be good at either making or buying, as they say, either doing or contracting for all of the elements that it takes to be able to make that happen.
Makes sense. So as we move into the next section of this, because I think we want to start getting a little bit more practical around transformational experiences, this next thing is more a statement, interpretation I made from your book, which I don't necessarily think was your intention, but I wanted to test to see if this is true. A lot of the conversation we're having at the moment is the idea of transformational experience. And I tend to be very guilty of that, is that I talk about the businesses that I need to convince about these experiences. But then on the other side, there are people who we are staging these experiences for. What I find very interesting in your book, you really play on this idea of theater. So the metaphor of a theater comes through super strong. What I find very interesting of theater, and it kind of reminded me a little bit of my days back at advertising agency, is that in a theater, you speak about an audience. What is great for me when you start thinking about the people you're building experience for as an audience is that, first of all, there's different layers of audience engagement, of course, but then you have to give a little bit of yourself to create an experience for an audience. And then the audience can either accept that experience or reject that. And then also you have to differentiate yourself because the audience might have seen this specific show before. Was that an intention when you thought about the theater? Did the audience aspect come into play in the way that I interpret that?
Though, let me start out by saying that evidently we weren't strong enough on theater in the book because it's not a metaphor, Werner. It's a model.
Okay.
It's not chapter 7 is entitled Work is Theater, not Work as Theater, right? That's a metaphor. No, we mean actually work is theater. That whenever workers are in front of customers, which are, as you say, the audience of their performance, then they're on stage and they're acting, whether they know it or not, whether they do it well or not, they are acting. I love the quote from a famed stage director from London, Peter Brook, in his book, The Empty Space, where he starts the book by saying that I can take any empty space and call it a bare stage. A man walks across this empty space while someone else is watching him, and that's all that is needed for an active theater to be engaged. Right. In other words, the simplest definition of acting is one person watches another person work. That's what acting is.
Yeah.
And so you literally are on stage. And then related to your question, that yes, it is an audience. In fact, we use a model from Richard Schechner. He's a professor, I think, at New York University. His book is called Performance Theory. He has this sort of circle drama where you go from that the core of what's going on is the drama, right? That's at the center. It's what change you want to make in the world. It's what you want your audience to understand, to perceive, how you want them to change in their thinking and even in their acting, their actions, excuse me.
Yeah.
And then around that is the script, right? So the script is the activities, the things that you do to enact that drama. That script then allows you to create the theater, right? Which defines all of the aspects of what's going on, where every performance can be slightly different, but that performance is the outside of the circle, and then you have the audience. So my partner, Jim Gilmore, and I, you know, we read his book and we looked at this and we realized that was the same with business. Well, in any business, your strategy is the drama. Your strategy is the change you want to be in the world, right? So your processes are activities that you do to, again, enact that strategy in the world. Then your work is theater and your offering is the performance.
Excellent.
How does brand fit into it?
Well, it's funny, you know, I've just never been a brand guy, you know, and I've always like hesitate to answer questions about brand and so forth. When we wrote our book, Authenticity, you know, where we realized that authenticity is personally perceived. And I think that's what the brand is. It's your perception of what's going on. I do understand that at least in today's world, and maybe this was never the case, but you can't control your brand. Your brand is in the minds of your customers and the other people and the shapeholders that shape your business. So you've got to manage that perception. In response to our 1998 Harvard Business Review article, Welcome to the Experience Economy, one person wrote in and how the brand is the promise of an experience. And I think that is a good definition, right? The brand is the promise of an experience. And then where authenticity comes in is like, well, did your actual experience meet the brand? The brand being what you say about yourself, is that what people actually encountered? And if not, that's going to get people perceived as phony.
A few years back, I've been talking to the people responsible for designing the Apple shop experience. Mm-hmm. We were discussing how they are introducing new solutions to the shop, what is the process there, how they create the whole ecosystem out of it, and so on. After they told about all the projects that they've done, I've asked, okay, like how do your customers react to all these ideas? Because from the businesses I'm talking to, I hear that if we do something inconsistent, people will get confused. So I ask, okay, like, so how do you create this consistency in Apple shops? And what they answered was that they educated their customers that they can be surprised by the new technologies and new things whenever they come to the store over time. They define the concept for the brand image for the shops, which is on the forefront of technological advancement in retail. Mm. And therefore, they could experiment within the sandbox that they've created through the idea of the brand image and then stage the experiences within the framework that they've set there. So I was wondering whether this is truly just the promise to the customers about what might happen, or could it become a design tool to define your experiences?
So it is that promise of the experience that when you go in a store, you're going to see something new. It's going to be at the forefront. But also that can then provide the organizing principle for the experience. You know, that every experience needs a theme, and it doesn't have to be fantasy theme like Disney parks. It doesn't have to be in your face like theme restaurants, but it simply is the organizing principle for how you decide what's in the experience versus what's out of the experience. If you have an organizing principle being out at the forefront of technology, then it helps you decide, okay, if something comes along, is this at the forefront or is this not at the forefront? If it's not, we can't do it. It allows you to make your experience cohesive by understanding that theme. You might state it a little differently for the actual theme of the store versus the overall branding that you want to have, but at least those have to be aligned. And if those are aligned, then you can align all of the cues that you have, the physical things that you have in the place and what workers do in that place to make it all come alive.
I want to loop back to the audience part for a moment, because one might make the mistake that when you think about audience, even an experience, even more in transformational experiences, that the audience is passive. Is that a risk that someone might lead?
That gets directly to a framework in chapter two. It's sort of the core 2x2 of the experience economy. It's one that academics in particular have really taken to. There's more research done on this framework than any other that talks about how experiences span the range from being passive to active. Passive is where you're not really affecting the experience much. Active is where you're totally a part of that experience and it doesn't happen without you. Passive experiences happen whether you're there or not. Going from absorption to immersion. Absorption is where the experience comes into you, and immersion is where you go into the experience. You can have entertainment experiences or passively absorbing in the sights and sounds that are presented to you on TV, in the movies, in a concert, in going to a play, and so forth. Educational experiences are active absorption, where you're absorbing in that information, but you're actively wrestling with it, doing things with it, applying it, and thereby you can learn from it. Escapist experience are active immersion. You go from one place to another. You actively do things there. Watching a golf tournament on TV is entertainment. Playing golf is escapist, for example. Number one industry in the world is the tourism industry, and it's that escapist experience primarily. And then there are aesthetic experiences where you're passively immersed in an environment where you just want to hang out and be. Cafes and often museums and other such places are aesthetic experiences. So one of the things that we realize is that there are no experiences that are at the end points of all this. There's, if you're totally passive, you're asleep, right? You're unconscious. So yeah. It's not that. So there's always some level of passiveness, some level of activeness, some level of absorption, some level of immersion. And that's why the best experiences, we think, hit the sweet spot in the middle, that have aspects of all four of these experience realms. You don't want to be on the extreme passive end. You want to get people active. So, you know, whichever end you are, you want to sort of like try to move to the middle by adding elements of the others. And it's interesting, though, that you said, Werner, that you think of transformations as passive, because I always consider them, you know, far more active than that.
No, again, my interpretation came across wrong. So my assumption would be that transformations is super active. It's like,
Yeah. Right, exactly. I would think so too. I misinterpreted that. Sorry. So, I mean, Aga mentioned before the neurosurgeon, where you're totally unconscious and being transformed on the table, you know, is absolutely passive if you're unconscious again. Although that you still have to do things after you get off the table to ensure your recovery. So that's where you then get active. And if you're smart, you are super active to make sure you do all the right things that it takes. So yeah, transformations are going to be more towards the active side, the set of experiences, but there's reasons and time for the passive as well. That there are times when you want to sit back and reflect, when you want to review what you have done and passively think about that in an environment where you have a respite from what you're doing to recharge your batteries and re-energize yourself so that you can then get active again. So I think that there is that possibility. In fact, in learning, there's a framework called the Kolb, K-O-L-B, Kolb Experiential Cycle. It talks about how you go through these various different phases in order to learn. And they don't, by learn, they just don't mean like in just a purely educational sense, but learn in a way that does, in fact, change who you are. And there is that part in there that is for the reflectiveness, that you have to reflect on it. And that becomes, I mean, still active mentally, obviously, in reflecting, but it is a more passive side of the experience when you get to that point.
Thanks. And then, funny enough, one of the influences you had on myself is that I didn't go through the metaphor. I went through the actual, what you said.
Right, exactly.
So I started realizing that in my design life, rather look at storytelling, look at what people in theaters are doing, look at improv and see how that can influence the way I design. But now when I look at transformational experiences, you mentioned that you guide a transformation. So my assumption is that if I jump out of the world of design and all our frameworks and maybe go and look at how people coach, how do people guide our people? How do people help other people? Would that be a good place to start to understand how the design of transformation experiences can happen?
Yes. I think that is a good place to look. There's been a huge rise in the last 20 years of the coaching profession outside of sports, where it's basically always been there, from your personal coach that takes you beyond a fitness center experience to a true transformation, because they'll do everything it takes to make sure you meet your goals, to life coaches, to business coaches. My partner and I are talking about looking at CXO coaching that help coach chief experience officers and how they can do their jobs better and really affect the transformation it takes internally to become a premier experience stager. So I think that that is a great place to look and see how they do their job, because they are guides. You know, they're equivalent to a guide. Oh, can I tell a quick story?
Please
that
do.
Just reminded me of, you can feel free to cut this out, but I was once doing a workshop with the top management of a Swiss company, and we were looking at the theme of their experience, and we realized we were really going beyond that to come up with the purpose. I mentioned, I think, before that there are multiple levels of intention, starting with the acting intention and then the theme of the experience, and you get up to the purpose of the company, the meaningful purpose. Why does it exist in the world? And so we came up with this great phrase, something like be the guide for the digital age. So I thought it was a really good because it went beyond experience to be a transformational, right? Because it had this. So we're going to help transform you to being ready and able to work and play in this new digital age. I said, this is perfect. I just love this. And the CEO sort of goes like, he says, it's too bad because it won't work. I says, what do you mean it won't work? He says, it won't work in Switzerland. Switzerland, we've got four languages. Everything has to work in English, French, Italian, and German. The word in German for guide is Führer.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
That's a problem.
I did not know. They've ruined the entire word for the whole country, right? Nobody can ever be a guide in Germany.
That's a brilliant story. I love it.
So how did it end?
They had to use a different term, and I don't know exactly. They went back to Switzerland and did their magic on it.
That's copyright. That's
awesome. Right, I love it. Right. I'm going to repeat that story.
So when you said it, it just occurred to me, because I love that story too. It's like, we have a German translation. I should look and see what it says when we get too guiding up there.
Yeah.
It's happening right now.
Looking up our progression of economic value. Erbe Führen. Führen is in the word.
Führen.
Right? Okay. Führer. H-E-R-B-E-I-F-U with an umlaut, H-R-E-N. I can Google translate that real quick. Well, that's interesting. Cause.
Ah.
Bring about, cause, induce. I mean, that's a decent term.
Actually, what you just said brought me to thinking about two of my clients, where I started using archetypes as ways to create the experience design narrative for them. I must admit, I'm surprised how powerful this tool is. So basically they get a set of with 40 different metaphors, and they are trying to choose the character, the archetype that fits what they want to achieve. And through this, we are building the metrics. We are trying to get to understand how they can measure it.
Right. So does the company take on the archetype, or an individual worker, or?
The company or the department.
Okay. Right.
So basically, if I'm talking on a management board level, I'm trying to convince them to think of an archetype, because archetype is a very easy notion for people to understand and interpret.
Yep.
If I'm talking about the departments and they have a vision, like the company, like vision, mission, whatever, I'm trying to say, take the vision that you've got and try to find an archetype that fits your mission and your role in the organization. With one of the companies, it was a customer service department, and they saw themselves as angels. Suddenly you know that your role is not to tell the people, hey, I can't do anything about your problem, but you are there to guide them and to protect them from making mistakes. So suddenly the whole behavior is defined through the archetype, which is quite powerful and allows me to start talking to them about what sort of experience is associated with this particular archetype.
I think that's beautiful, Aga. I mean, we've done things similar. We generally use the term persona to take on, but it is sort of a theater technique. So I'm on stage, and what is my role? My role can be a persona, it can be an archetype. And I think that's a beautiful way for people for overall to be able to see. I mean, you think angels is a beautiful term, right? If you are an angel, then there are certain ways you have to act and certain things that you just will not do because of that. You remind me of my teaching at Columbia University on Monday. I taught on theater. And one of the people I mentioned was at Zappos.com, the shoe company that Amazon bought that's famous for having the best call center in the world. Big thing is that they don't measure average hold time. They don't measure how little time they spend with customers. They, in fact, celebrate how much time they spend every day with customers. And one guy there who I've met, shared a podium together, John Wolski is his name. He's the chief culture evangelist, but he started in a call center. And he said his persona was rock star. He was a rock star. He had a big sign in his cubicle, right? You are a rock star. And so when he got on the phone, his body language was different. His posture was different. How he talked and how he interacted was different because his archetype was, I am a rock star. In that case, everybody can have a different archetype. They can pick what is the persona that they want to take on. You can figure out, this is who I'm going to be. And you can even change it call to call. or day to day. Well, Zappos has this overall theme about delivering happiness. The only thing you can't do or shouldn't do is take on an archetype that's at odds with that theme. You can't take on the archetype of what we call in the U.S. Debbie Downer, that is always pessimistic about everything, because it's not going to be how you deliver happiness. But if you take on something that's consistent with the purpose and with the theme that you want to do, then you can change it. You can do different things. You can play with it. You can have a lot of fun. You can create a great experience.
Yeah. Love it. Okay. Should I continue? Or
go for it. No, go for it. I guess you're, you've got the stage.
Well, to that point, and again, this is something you can delete. The stage does not have to be a physical stage. Zappos, their stage is that phone. I'll use the term line, even though it's usually not a line today. Yeah. But that phone line, that connection that they have with just their voice, is the stage that they're on. Just like we here having this conversation are on a stage that enables an experience to happen. We hope for the listeners of it.
Beautiful.
Absolutely. You know, like there is very little educational training for experienced designers. You mentioned Colombia, and I'm guessing that you are probably teaching this domain.
Yes.
What are the qualities and the skills that an experienced designer should have?
Yeah, interesting question. Yeah, so I teach a course at Columbia. My partner, Jim Gilmore, is now a full-time professor at Case Western Reserve University. BYU, Brigham Young University in California, just changed the name of their hospitality to experience design and management, right? So the hospitality program is now experience design and management. In Denmark, you can get master's degrees in experience thinking, experience design, even experience economy, they'll often call it. And there is some in Estonia and Russia, I know of. In terms of what makes a good experience designer, I think it can come from all sorts of backgrounds. You think that it does need sort of an artist temperament, again, because it is more art than science. It certainly needs people that are open to thinking. I've got a colleague, Kevin Dully. He's known as the Idea Freak is his Twitter handle. He has a company called The Thinking Canvas. In The Thinking Canvas, he capitalizes the I-N-K of thinking because he's a drawer. He's an architect by trade, which is another great place for looking for experience designers. He can draw, and I can't draw. I love people who can draw, and he can draw extemporaneously. He can draw what the conversation is about. He's come to our Think About events, and every day he's sitting there drawing and comes up with these overall poster boards of each of the days of the event. He came to our Experience Economy Expert Certification course, you know, our 4.5-day immersion in the experience economy, and every day was how he took notes was drawing, and every day resulted in this poster board again. So, you know, that's just a wonderful skill that can enhance how you think about design experiences, storyboarding of them, scripting. I think writing can be a big deal. You need to understand words and vocabulary. The core tools of the business of for Jim and I is a thesaurus and a dictionary. It's understanding words and looking them up and what the options are and so forth. So you can come at it from you know, those sorts of, you know, artistic or at least semi-artistic creative thinking. But there are people that are very much left-brained and very much didactic and pedantic in how they think about it that also can become great designers because they're down in the details and they really sweat those details, and that makes a big difference. So obviously, I mean, very few experiences come out of the mind of any one person. It's going to be a team. And so having a team with many different characteristics that all come together and work together well is you know, the paramount importance.
Now, Joe, I mean, there might be this misperception that you are a man of leisure that just smokes cigars and talk about clever
and golf.
Things,
right? Don't forget the golf.
That's what I thought. And the golf. And the golf, right? But you're also in the world and you do consulting for top-end, high-end clients. Can you talk a little bit about your consulting business?
Sure. I mean, the primary thing that I do is speaking, teaching, workshops. So the speeches are to get people excited, to start to change their mind, change their thinking, build that platform under which they can then shift into the experience economy. Workshops are there to help them generate ideas, often led by a learning excursion or an experience expedition to a city. You know, experience some of the best and sometimes the worst experiences there to understand principles and get the juices flowing. We do our Experience Economy Expert Certification course here in the U.S., and then we have private courses for individual companies or individual locales around the world. Started the firm, we really did not want to start a big firm and have what we called a lot of hungry mouths to feed. So we don't do projects ourselves.
And Joe, like off the cuff, is there specific problems or let's say rather challenges that clients usually come to you with? Things that continuously pop up as, Joe, please come help us with this.
The back of our business cards, we have our tagline. It says, helping executives see the world differently. And that's what we do, right? Is we help them see the world differently. And you may notice in the very back there, it's at the end, it says EM. It's not a trademark, which are for goods, a TM. It's not an SM, a service mark. It's an experience mark. You know, that's
experience mark. Brilliant.
It's an experience mark. And so that's what we're about, is we help them see the world differently, point them in the right directions, what they need to do, help them develop ideas that they can then take and implement.
This is a question that we've been moving around a little bit in our flow, and I snuck it in because I sit currently in one of the big consulting firms. Topic that comes up all the time, and I was thinking, like, how do I fit this into the whole idea of the experience economy and transformation, this digital transformation? I think you alluded a little bit to that, but how does the whole idea around digital transformation fit into this transformational experiences?
The biggest thing that's sort of going on in the world of business today is digital transformation. And it means a lot of different things for different companies. But at its core, I think it means, you know, how do we as a company embrace digital technology and use it to make a difference in our business? Most companies, when they're doing that, are really using it at the back end. But there's also then this front end component that the companies work on, is how do we interact with customers? But for the most part, it's the transformation of the physical to the digital in how we do things. And less so what it needs to be is how do we fuse the physical and digital and how we create value for our customers. And I think that increasingly customers do look for new and wondrous experiences that fuse the real and the virtual. It was like now over 10 years ago where I really started thinking about this. I knew that's the one thing in our original edition of the Experience Economy we really didn't address, is that what was going on digitally. You know, the World Wide Web was only a baby back then, and now it's a behemoth. And so I wanted to spend some time. I've got a background in technology from my 13 years at IBM and my time at MIT and so forth. And so I'm trying to understand it and develop a framework. And that framework is what I call the multiverse model that's in my book, Infinite Possibility, talks about what are all the ways that you can fuse the real and the virtual. And we sort of define 8 different experience realms in there for that. But within them, there's so much possibility that I just couldn't think of anything else other than name it, infinite possibility. To the extent that the infinity is possible within the universe, digital technology enables infinite possibility for how we can create value.
I'm going to have to grab that book, definitely. I must shamelessly admit that I haven't read it yet. So I need to make a plan, because I think there's some secrets hidden in there.
Well, then maybe we can have a whole nother conversation, Werner.
Okay, cool. We've recorded that statement.
Excellent. All right. Great.
Joe, and then talking about secrets, right?
Yes.
What motivates you? What is it that gets you going?
Okay.
Spot on. So now that you're unmuted, Edgar. So Joe, I mean... So Joe, I mean, just getting back to the, to segue into the final part of this, it's always interesting because we talk about your book, we talk about the business, we talk about experience economy and experience design, but I don't think I've ever asked you this, even when we met at the college, is what motivates you? What makes you get up in the morning? What gets you, keep you going in this space?
Well, I hadn't formulated this until probably 2 or 3 years ago, and I realized it is what makes me tick. It is my purpose in life is to figure out what's going on in the world of business and then develop frameworks that first describe what's happening and then prescribe what companies can do about it. I very, you know, probably hubristically started to talk about the universe of thought, that all these things relate together. None of the things I talk about are off in their own independent, you know, universes over there. They all relate together. And I love working with people to extend it and to think about, where does it take us? And it's all about creating greater economic value for businesses. When the experience economy first came out, there was some criticism of it about how it is a producer mindset and sort of leaves out the consumer. And but I'll say unapologetically, that's where I come from. It's businesses. But of course, it's businesses. It's how do you create value for your consumers or for your customers? So I don't think they're left out at all, but it is that perspective. Obviously, consumers have many experiences that have nothing to do with the economy, have transformations that have nothing to do with the economy, just like there could be services, goods, and commodities that they don't buy, that they grow themselves, they make themselves, they deliver themselves. But from an economic perspective, what can businesses do to create greater value in the world? And I think businesses are the greatest force of good in the world, in fact, as they do that.
So if you were to recommend a book, we've got the recommendations for your book.
Yeah, other than Infinite Possibility and Authenticity, yes. Right?
Yep.
So this is one, again, that I referred to in my class on Monday at Columbia University. I think it is appropriate because of the user experience perspective that you come from. And it's what I consider to be a classic book is Brenda's Laurel's Computers as Theater. So it's a wonderful book because the case that Brenda makes is that we need to view our human-computer interactions not as an interface, but as theater. I met her once, and I don't think she liked me because I talked about her unfortunate as, that she shouldn't have called computers as theater. She just said computers is theater or are theater, and she didn't like that. But in the book, she actually does say that. You know, she does say it's not a metaphor. She does say that it's a model, but she titled it Computers as Theater. But it's just a wonderful book. It's where you first appreciated how you can take digital things and make them into experiences. It's where I first learned of the Freytag diagram that people in theater circles learn today. It's a diagram of how plays change over time. It's the design of time again that was first figured out by Gustav Freytag, a German performance theorist from 1898. And her version, I love her version of it. There's many different versions. I love her version of it the best, and that's the one that I teach as well. So I think for all user experience designers, I think though anybody interested in design experiences of any kind can learn a lot about theater as well as about computers with that book.
One thing for any experienced designer to always remember, what would it be?
To recognize that you are in the experience business. You're not a industrial designer of goods. You're not a service designer. You are an experience designer. You're in the business of staging experiences with theater. They have to be dramatic, that therefore they have to be memorable. They have to be personal. They have to be, most of all, engaging. And if you have that mindset of experience design as opposed to all those other types of design, then you will be able to create great, engaging, memorable, dramatic, cohesive, robust experiences.
This amen. Is an awesome ending.
Dollar.
Joe. Give me an amen.
Amen.
Joe, thank you so very much for our conversation today. We are really grateful that you found the time for us.
An absolute pleasure. It was just a wonderful conversation. I enjoyed it very much.
And that was Aga and Werner on Catching the Next Wave podcast. And we will be back.